Councils, we're getting ready for our next case. I will call it A231415, Phillips versus State of Minnesota. Council, you're familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for a rebuttal. We ask that you state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking. Let us know how we can reference you this morning. These matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted. We have some people coming in. We'll let them all come in before we get started. And I'll just remind everyone in the courtroom that these matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted today, okay? You just want to wait one more moment, counsel, while everyone gets settled. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Devondre Phillips. Before I begin, I think that in this particular setting, I would just like to acknowledge how much I understand how difficult a case this is to contemplate. But I am here to argue the law as it relates to this conviction and this appeal. In this case, what I'm arguing in this appeal is that the state obtained a conviction of my client by successfully arguing that Mr. Phillips had a duty to retreat before his right to self-defense ever arose. That is contrary to law. Self-defense is permitted when you must resist an offense against the person. That's in the statute 609.06. The duty to retreat cannot arise before that. Nevertheless, that theory was relentlessly pushed at trial by the state. The confusion it created was demonstrated by the jury's question several hours into deliberation. When it seemed they had had a lot of time to go over the evidence, they sent the question, at what point does the duty to retreat arise? When there is an active imminent threat of harm, or when it could develop but has not yet? After conferring with counsel, as this court knows, the district court simply reread back the one sentence line that it is the duty to avoid the danger if possible. Well, that wasn't much of a re-instruction because that instruction cannot be read without having it in tandem with the law of self-defense that it relates to. As the judge instructed for each and every attempted murder account, it is legal to use force to defend yourself in the face of an imminent threat of bodily harm. The facts in this case.
So, if I could just ask a question. With the first individual who was shot, was there an imminent threat? I mean, there have been a lot of threats previous over the prior few months, and nobody was shot then. So why are we to say that threatening language, but there wasn't a gun in his hand at the time that the threat was made? Why should we find that that was imminent?
Well, I'll cite three grounds for why that was and could be regarded as an imminent threat of harm. One, it was the state's theory throughout the trial that Mr. Phillips was supposed to leave before he ever received that threat of imminent bodily harm. Secondly, it was not contested at trial that Mr. Hoffman was armed when he issued that threat. The prosecutor conceded in closing argument that a gun is visible in his waistband, and he then went further to say that you could see Walker removing it from his waistband right where you saw the bulge before. Then there's Mr. Phillips' testimony that he saw Mr. Hoffman was armed. Thirdly, I'm relying on this court's recent decision in Valdez to show a corollary example of when someone issues a death threat, it is not unreasonable to draw a gun. Now, in Valdez, he filed some seconds later to defend someone else, but the principle is the same. The fact is that defense counsel in this trial didn't even need to elaborate on the fact that there were multiple incidents over the summer where my client had guns pointed at him or was shot at by these same three individuals, at Flameburger, at Bourne's Bar, and on the street, I believe off Rice Street, where he was near his auntie's house or his grandmother's house, where immediately after his car was shot at, He got a FaceTime message from Brown or Hoffman, I don't remember which, saying, come on out again. So the evidence here is ample that Mr. Phillips, when he was threatened that he was dead by a man he knew was armed, with Walker to his left and Brown closing in from the right, that they meant business, just as the defendant in Valdez knew that Gutierrez meant business when he said, I'm going to kill you, to Mongara on the ground.
Couldn't the jury, though, I mean, do we have to just look, like we have to ignore everything that leads up to that moment in looking at the duty to retreat? Couldn't the jury hear, and it's a sufficiency of the evidence challenge, right? You're not challenging the jury instructions.
I'm not challenging the jury
instructions. I mean, setting aside your arguments about the prosecutor's questions and closing. I just lost my train of thought. So here, within an hour of being picked up at the airport, your client buys a gun and goes into this bar, and he's been warned in the parking lot before, you know, about something, not warned, maybe not a specific warning, but there's comments about these guys are looking for you, you better, something, right?
He already knew they were looking for him, Your Honor, yeah. If I can interrupt.
So couldn't the jury put that all together and look at it the way that the state was arguing this case?
The jury could definitely put together and see that there was a potentially dangerous situation there. But to the statement that you made at the start of your comment, are we to ignore everything that happened before Hoffman issued the death threat? In analyzing the law of self-defense, yes. Self-defense only applies in the face of an imminent threat of bodily harm. The words that Hoffman used were also not contested by the state, very likely because their whole theory was that my client was supposed to leave that bar before he was ever actually threatened. So in this case, the fact that he brought a gun to the scene is also not dispositive because that same fact was present in the Edwards case in 2007 and the most similar case to this, Austin, which was Austin brought a gun to a bar where he knew his antagonists were. That was not a factor in their analysis. The only factor in the analysis in Edwards and Austin was when and how he used the gun. The difference in Edward and Austin is that those defendants fired their guns at the defendants without provocation, without threat. That's why they were the first aggressor, and that's why they had no self-defense to begin with. That is totally the opposite situation here. So the fact that Mr. Phillips chose to buy a gun in the parking lot for protection and go into the bar with it, at least according to Edwards and Austin, is not relevant to this court's analysis. The only issue is, when his life was threatened by the armed Hoffman, did he have a right to defend himself? Yes. Hoffman's threat made Hoffman the first aggressor. At that point, he had no viable path of retreat. Hoffman was in front of him. Walker was to his left. He had the soda machine to his right. Brown was closing in front of him to his right. His back is to a wall in a defensive position. He used the force he needed to stop a guy who had already pointed a gun at him and shot at him over the summer. After he did that, contrary to respondents' argument, he did not just start blasting wildly. It shows clearly on the video, I believe Exhibit 213, the one facing the taco truck, that after he shot Hoffman, he took at least 5 or 6 steps forward straight towards the exit. That was his plan. It's when he looked to his right and he saw Brown raising his gun that he started shooting at Brown. This could tie in then the issue of, was the level of force reasonable? My client was shot 4 times by Brown, in the shin, in the leg, severing his femoral artery, in the back, and in the arm. There was no other way for my client to defend his life than to fire back at Brown. The notion that he fired first was made completely irrelevant by eliciting from Sergeant Ryan on cross that those shots came less than 0.2 seconds apart. He saw Brown raising a gun. He needed to get out the front door.
Later, the, not the initial, not the shooting of Mr. Hoffman.
No, this was after Hoffman was
right.
down.
Okay.
My client, it shows it straight on Exhibit 213 and 215. He made a beeline for the front door, but Brown was raising his gun, so my client fired back. He tried to express his regret for what happened, but his testimony is laced with statements that his life was in dire danger. He knew it. He knew that these guys were going to shoot him, and he couldn't just walk away. He couldn't just turn his back and hope they wouldn't shoot at him. For law on that, I'll rely on the Gardner case I cited, where the Supreme Court held a long time ago, yes, but it's still pertinent, that perhaps in the face of knives or clubs, it may be reasonable to try to dodge an armed assailant. But it is folly to think that that can be safely done when someone has a gun and they know how to use it. And the Brown v. U.S. Supreme Court case I cited said essentially the same thing.
Counsel, did you look at Baker at all?
The name is not ringing a bell, Your Honor.
There was a case in Eagan or someplace where a drug deal went bad, and the initial aggressors had pointed a gun at a guy's head and then took off with his money, basically, and he pursued them and gunned one down.
That sounds like Austin, yes. I didn't look at Baker, though.
Baker.
Yeah, but that's what happened in Austin.
Okay, and the key, I think, in a sense, in that case, since I was on the panel, I have a little more familiarity.
In
with
Baker?
It. Yeah.
Okay.
Was the sophistication, in a way, of Mr. Baker compared to the other assailants and how that impacted reasonable use of force and some other things in a case that isn't all that dissimilar from yours.
It is in one notable way, if I may say. The assailants had turned and run away. They were leaving. And Mr. Baker apparently chased after them to shoot them. That is contrary, that's not self-defense.
What if he chased after them to make a citizen's arrest or to recover his property? He has a right to.
Well, except that he didn't. He shot them. That's
at a certain point after they leveled their guns at him again.
If he had the opportunity to defend himself, it was when they had their guns pointed at him, not when he ran away. That's the exact holding from Austin. In Austin, they were fighting in the lower bar, but then Mr. Austin's antagonist left, and he was upstairs in another part of the bar. You know, instead of Austin coming out of the bathroom and leaving the clearly marked exit in that lower bar, he chased after them up the stairs and shot the guy in the back. I can't see a difference between that and how you're describing Baker. I also fail to see any level of sophistication involved with someone chasing after somebody who just put a gun to their head. That sounds to me like a totally rash act.
Or someone who's just a cold-blooded killer.
And again, I'm not sure how that inference can be drawn. I don't know what the holding from Baker was. But if the court is now alluding to the testimony from Sergeant Ryan that my client actually somehow set a trap for these three men, that is just literally without any evidentiary support, and one need only watch Exhibit, I think, 213, which is the camera facing the taco truck, to see that there was nothing more happening there than my client seeing the three of them by the front door, stroking his chin, playing with his necklace, and just sort of back and forth waddling, and then retreating over to the furthest point directly in front of the door. That the whole left side of the bar was open there. It wasn't a funnel.
Yeah, but doesn't your position rely on your client's claim that he hadn't noticed those three in the bar before the shooting?
Not at all. Not at all, Your Honor. Because the issue is when the right to self-defense arose, did he or could he exercise the duty to retreat then? Not before. Your Honor, I am extremely concerned to think that the state's theory in this case could stick and become law, because it will then basically require anybody who's ever been threatened to turn around and leave a place where they see someone who's their antagonist, to avoid losing their right to self-defense if they wind up getting attacked by this person. That's basically what happened here. My client didn't have to stay out of truck park just because Brown, Hoffman, and Walker might be there, nor should any other person have to stay out of a place where someone who has threatened their life before might be. We can't have a society like
that. Reading Edwards, though, I mean, it seems like the linchpin of your argument is that we have to ignore everything else. And even if the jury was convinced that he, in fact, saw and knew that the three of them were there in the bar, that he had a right to stay in the bar. I mean, it's different than somebody's home. I mean, the law is quite different there when it comes to self-defense. But, I mean, quoting Edwards, and I will note that you only quoted half of the sentence in Edwards. What you quoted in your brief is, the duty to retreat relates to the election to kill. The rest of the sentence says, making a killing unjustified if the danger was reasonably avoidable. And then the Supreme Court goes on and talks about the justification that I won't take up all this time, but it's limited by an objective standard where society would agree that the use of deadly force was necessary, and a part of that objectivity analysis includes the duty to retreat, if at all possible, to avoid the harm. So how do you jive that statement of the law, relatively recent, 2006, with your saying we have to ignore everything else, even if the jury were to assume that he saw it, which I think is a reasonable inference
from
the evidence presented.
Go ahead, counsel.
That he knew the three of them were in the bar.
There's nothing about the rest of that sentence that's inconsistent with the argument that I'm bringing here, and I left it out because it was redundant. The danger in that second part of the sentence is when it is imminent. That's when the issue the rest of that sentence describes comes into play. If it can be reasonably avoided is when the danger happens, Your Honor. And I'm going to cite the case that respondent is relying on, State v. Fidel, because respondent was trying to argue that merely being surrounded by a hostile group creates a duty to retreat. No, it did not. It was not until one of those hostile people told Fidel, I'm going to kick your ass, that the need and the right for self-defense arose. That's when the actual danger presented itself, and that's when he was supposed to retreat on the clear line that he had back to his apartment. My client had no clear line of duty to retreat when the danger presented itself. It's not potential danger, Your Honor. That's the mistake of law that applies in this case. It is actual imminent danger. That's in the statute, that's in Edwards, Austin, and in this case. Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel?
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Alexandra Meyer, and I represent Respondent State of Minnesota. Appellant blithely quotes cases, specifically Edwards, Austin, and Thurston, in support of his position, but the actual holdings of these cases, the facts they're based on, and the standards of review employed when examined more closely do not support appellant's position. Appellant cites Thurston from 1974 in both his principal and his reply brief for the proposition that the testimony of the accused is sufficient to establish that the victim was the first aggressor. But that is not what the case actually represents. In Thurston, the district court wouldn't allow the defendant to call witnesses to testify that the victim had previously threatened to shoot him and bought a gun for that purpose. Thurston does not stand for any sort of principle that the testimony of the accused is sufficient to prove who was the aggressor, merely that it is sufficient to put that question before the jury. Instead, in cases like appellants involving challenges to the sufficiency of the state's evidence disproving a self-defense claim, this court rejects testimony inconsistent with the jury's verdicts, which in this case includes appellant's testimony that Hoffman made a death threat to him just before the shooting. This court should defer to the jury's verdict, especially where the state, in cross-examining appellant, impeached that testimony. Specifically on pages 1100 and 1130 of the transcript, the prosecutor confronted appellant's version of events where appellant is himself saying something to Hoffman, a fact confirmed by the video, which appellant then repeatedly denies. The jury was perfectly entitled to reject the testimony that Mr. Hoffman had made a threat to appellant.
Counsel is presenting the question of the imminent nature of the threat as one of law to us. Is it your position that that is a jury question? Like when the threat becomes imminent, and then what is the authority to support that proposition?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. And
you would agree with what?
I would agree that it is a jury question.
And what's the authority for that proposition?
I could point to Judge Siegel's reference to Edwards, where the court said that it is the reasonableness matters. Whether and when you avoid the danger matters, and when danger is imminent would be a distinction that the jury would make based on all the facts and circumstances. I would look at Austin.
All the facts and circumstances when? I think that's the question, right? How big is the circle of information that a person has? I mean, where are we here? What do we look at to determine when a threat is imminent?
Well, I think we don't look at the definition of imminent from a robbery statute, which is the only thing that appellant is citing as what imminent means. But imminent is not specifically defined in the JIG, but I would say it's a common word that the jury could understand. Imminent danger, what does that mean? It means a basis for reasonable fear. That's another part of the self-defense instruction, would be the objective and the subjective reasonableness of the reaction in self-defense. And I think that is part of the consideration the jury gets to look at. Here you have from the moment the parties are all in the bar, those are all circumstances the jury gets to consider when determining at what point the apprehension of danger is reasonable. And I don't think there's any case law that says that the jury cannot consider that. The reasonableness standards in these cases has been held repeatedly to not support a self-defense claim where the facts involve a previous beef, a grudge, or a feud between the parties that reignites. There is no self-defense claim objectively where the defendant tries to, quote, seek out and even the score with his antagonists, and that's from Soyne, or accepts the invitation to fight, and that comes from Suco.
So there's not a suggestion that he sought these fellows out at the time the shooting occurred, though they were coming towards him, it sounds like. Like the video shows that.
He procured a gun, having gotten off a plane an hour previously. He went out of his way to arm himself and enter this bar. And the facts that the jury could consider support that he believed he was about to be involved in this altercation, that he knew it was coming. Specifically, you had the testimony of the nephew saying he knew he would be pressed or something to that effect. He told his friends these men were going to press him. He spoke to Brown's girlfriend, his cousin, and knew that Brown would be there. There was evidence that the jury could understand what that meant. Mr. Hoffman was large and hard to miss in the bar when he was only an arm's length away from appellant. And appellant, importantly, stayed in the bar and chose to back up instead of going with his companions through the bar and out. And that is moments before this all happened. So he, at that point, based on all of those facts and more, a reasonable jury could find that there was an imminent danger to him based on everything he knew about the circumstances.
But isn't it reasonable for him to believe that if he just turns and walks away, he's going to get shot in the back?
Not at the point that he's able to do that. The prosecutor also stressed that he could have asked for help, he could have reported this to the police, he could have taken any sort of action that was honest and in good faith to avoid the conflict. And that is overall what we do not have here. His actions were not honest and good faith. And that applies to all claims of self-defense. And again, to reiterate that the only evidence supporting that Mr. Hoffman made a threat against appellant is appellant's own testimony, which was significantly and repeatedly impeached. Appellant is arguing inconsistent descriptions of appellant's location at the time of the shooting, saying it was both wide open, so Gardner should apply, and he was blocked in by the taco truck and therefore could not retreat. But I would point you to Austin, which specifically rejected applying Gardner in this circumstance, where you're in a bar with multiple armed assailants. The court specifically said that in Austin, the appellant was misapplying Gardner. This case is not about when the duty to retreat attaches. This is a challenge to the jury's rejection of appellant's version of events. And this court's review is not related to appellant's right to assert self-defense or his claim that the jury was improperly instructed as to his duty to retreat, but whether based on the evidence presented, the state disproved his self-defense claim. It did overwhelmingly, especially within the context of whether appellant's actions were objectively reasonable and whether he was acting honestly and in good faith. If this court has no further questions.
Could you address the issue of Sergeant Ryan's testimony about fatal funnel? I mean, that seems to be a pretty inflammatory phrase.
It's potentially, but the context in which appellant is challenging it is that the witness made a used a legal term of art, and the case law he's pointing at says the use of murder versus the use of the term killed. Or in this case, if he had said he used self-defense, that would be objectionable. That would be worth challenging. But the term fatal funnel, it was not, the prosecutor did not elicit it. It was not prohibited by the trial court. And then defense counsel highlighted it, brought it back up, got into this. If you look at the transcript pages where defense counsel is cross-examining Sergeant Ryan, he goes on and on about how this isn't a fatal funnel and challenges his right to know, you know, whether he's the, how he could know this based on his training and experience. So it was emphasized and overemphasized by defense counsel. It was not objected to, and it was not, in fact, the prohibited term of art or statement of the, I've lost the word, the ultimate issue, the ultimate fact. Additionally, I would say that the two cases appellant relies on, Valtierra and Mendoza, involved the testimony of experts as triangulation, so somewhat similar, but in both of those cases, we're in a different standard of review. In Valtierra, it was found to be an abuse of discretion over counsel's objection. And in Mendel-Mendoza, it was a relevancy objection, and it was found to be harmless error. But here, we're considering this in the context of unobjected to prosecutorial misconduct. If there's no further questions, I ask that you affirm.
It appears not. Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Maravilli, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And let me just ask you, why isn't the jury tasked with the responsibility of determining from the totality of circumstances in any given particular case what the nature of the threat is at the time of the action? I mean, why doesn't the jury get to decide whether something is imminent?
They are tasked with that. And
from the totality of circumstances.
They are tasked with that very thing, and the judge repeatedly instructed them that self-defense arises in the face of an imminent threat. Mm-hmm. I cited the case on the definition for that just to illustrate it, but you know what the judge instructs the jury. It says, where I have defined terms, apply them. Where I have not defined a term, use common, ordinary meaning. Everybody knows what imminent means. Happening right now. Okay, or very quickly.
Does everybody know what that means? I mean, if you know that there are three men looking for you with an intent to kill you, that's in your mind. I mean, if I knew that there were three men looking to kill me with an intent to kill me, I would feel threatened right now.
You know, Your Honor, I think the reason that it's not defined in the instructions is because the meaning of imminent is obvious. And
Or is it, given Edwards, that a reasonable interpretation given the circumstances would be appropriate?
Well, I wanted to address Edwards in my response and in my rebuttal because you asked the question, when is the threat imminent? And Edwards does explain that in depth. It says that it is when there is more than mere conversation. It says at a minimum, there must be a quarrel that has ensued with potentially serious consequences. So what I did in my brief was I then cited Blevins, because this court's decision, which I understand is on review now, was about at what point did Blevins have the right to self-defense? And everybody agrees that when he walked onto that platform, somebody said something to him so threatening that he pulled out his machete. See, that is what imminent means. The difference between my case and Blevins is that he had a train right behind him that he could have just got on and left. My client had a taco truck behind him. So I am relying steadfastly on Edwards' definition of what an imminent threat is. It is not something potential. It is not something that you fear could happen. It relates to the law of self-defense as described in Statute 609.06. You can't have a duty to retreat until you have a right to self-defense, and self-defense is what you are allowed to do when you are confronted with the threat of immediate harm. It's not before that. If you strike preemptively, you lose. You get prosecuted for murder. And that strikes me as, you know, that was available to this case. You know, if they wanted to say that my client somehow planned this as a cold-blooded killer, they should have just prosecuted him for conspiracy to commit murder against Brown, Allen, and Walker. They didn't. The thing is that if my client did have that attribute, after he shot the threatening Hoffman, he would have advanced firing at Brown immediately, if that was his intent, because Brown was right there and he didn't have his gun up yet. But my client took 5 or 6 steps forward without even raising his gun, straight towards the front door. It was only after he saw Brown raise his gun that he fired in self-defense in the face of an imminent threat. And Brown's gun fired at virtually the same time. The law of self-defense.
So I wasn't comparing your client to Mr. Baker.
I'm sorry, I thought you were, Your Honor. I
was just using that to follow up on a comment you made about how sophisticated these folks might be at gunfights and the like.
I apologize for the strident tone I'm using. I think that my client was improperly denied his right to self-defense. Do I think that this situation was ideal? I do not. But to take where I think the court's questioning is gone, yes, this case must be forced into the narrow prism of when the law of self-defense arises, and then everything else is after that. And I just can't stress enough how telling that jury question was. It was at like 8, the foreperson wrote 8-ish p.m. I think they got retired around 4. They had been deliberating for hours. They clearly were not hung up on the issue of who the first aggressor was, whether there was an honest fear of serious bodily harm, nor whether the level of force used was reasonable. They were clearly just hung up on the question, does it have to be an active, imminent threat? See, they created their own definition. They associated imminent threat with active threat. Or they wrote, is it just something potential? It is not potential. He had no duty to retreat until Hoffman threatened his life with a gun sticking out of his waistband and Walker lurking to his left, Brown closing in from the right. Thank you for listening to my arguments.
Thank you very much, counsel. We appreciate the presentation of the issues, and we will issue our opinion in the statutory time period.